Biden, Blinken, and Austin are not only morally and politically complicit, but they're legally complicit.
Reid, has there been any precedent in terms of the aiding and abetting of provision in the past before the court?
Absolutely. I mean, our case is based on very solid precedents. The best example is the case of Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, who was convicted by the special court of Sierra Leone for aiding and abetting the rebels in Sierra Leone, you know, the ones who cut off people's hands, arms, a country that he never set his foot in. And they said Charles Taylor was aware of the crimes that were being committed by his Sierra Leonean allies, and yet he continued to give them arms and he continued to encourage them. What I like to say is, imagine that a gunman is on a killing spree, and he runs into a store. The owner knows what the man is doing. He said, quick, I need more ammunition. And the owner says, here, but be careful how you use it. That's the situation we're in. These officials were aware of what was being done with their ammunition, except in our case, they also tried to stifle criticism of what the gunman was doing, and they did it again and again.
And Reid, you filed this under an Article 15 submission. What is that precisely?
So under Article 15 of the ICC's governing Rome statute, NGOs, individuals, victims can provide information to the ICC prosecutor. Now, the ICC prosecutor already has an investigation open into the crimes committed by Hamas and committed by Israeli officials. So this will go into that. The prosecutor does not usually talk about what he does with his investigation. We know that investigation is ongoing. And what we're saying is, don't just go. I mean, we're hoping that, of course, other individuals in the theater are named, but we also say, look at the people behind them. Look at the people who have aided and abetted this.
Reid, earlier this month, President Trump signed an executive order authorizing sanctions against the ICC over its war crimes investigations against Israel. Dawn has stated that Trump's order against the ICC could subject him to, quote, individual criminal liability for obstruction of justice. Can you explain what that's about and what you're asking for regarding Trump as well?
Sure. Well, we didn't ask for it in the communication, but as you say, under Article 70 of the ICC Rome Statute, it criminalizes and as an offense against the administration of justice, what we Americans call obstruction of justice, to, for instance, retaliate against a court officer for taking action. So here the prosecutor has indicted, Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Trump administration has responded by levying sanctions on this man and on the court. So that really sets, I mean, the prosecutor would be well within his rights to open up an investigation of Donald Trump for these sanctions, as he would, incidentally, for the 9 years that Israel tried with three successive prosecutors to blackmail, harass, and sting them to prevent them from taking these actions.
Reid Brody, we thank you very much for being with us, veteran war crimes prosecutor, board member of Dawn, the nonprofit which has filed the communication with the ICC prosecutor over the role of U.S. officials, Biden, Blinken, and Austin, in supporting Israeli war crimes in Gaza. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Anjali Hamid, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Arjun Das. You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm joined today by Dave Mawinney. Dave, how's it going?
It's going great, Arjun.
Yeah, so Pittsburgh is known for many things. Winning at football, losing at baseball, pierogies, steel mills, and soon enough it might be known for something new, tech startups. That's in no small part, thanks to our friend here, the efforts of today's guest, Dave Mawinney. Dave is the executive director of the Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship at CMU's Tepper School of Business, which is one of the premier hubs for startup activity in the Pittsburgh metro area. So, Dave, you're a Pittsburgh kid. Tell us how you got to startups and how'd you find out that it was a viable career path?
Oh, wow. So, I grew up a grandson of a steelworker, the son of a Presbyterian minister. So I was at the low end of the middle class. And when I graduated high school, the steel industry tanked and everybody left town. And I was seeing some people be successful in other cities. I would read Forbes magazine. I would read Fortune magazine, and they would talk about the entrepreneurs. And I would think to myself, why not? Why couldn't I pursue that? And so it was something that stuck in my head through my undergraduate education. And I was actually getting a PhD in physics at Georgia Tech. And I realized that the tech side wasn't the side that I would be the best at. It was at the selling side. And so I decided then to be an entrepreneur. And that led me back to Carnegie Mellon, where at the time it was pre-internet. You couldn't learn to be an entrepreneur on the internet. You had to go to business school to be an internet. And Carnegie Mellon had one of the best business schools in the world, and it had one of the first entrepreneurship programs in the world. In 1971, the president of the university, Dick Seyert, hired Jack Thorne to start the first entrepreneurship program at any university. So that reputation led me here, and from that point, I launched my entrepreneurial career.
Interesting. So what was the first company that you founded?
Yeah. So a guy named Don Jones was a successful entrepreneur in the Pittsburgh area, and he gave $1 million in 1989, which was a lot of money in 1989, to found the Don Jones Center for Entrepreneurship at the Tepper School of Business. I was very fortunate to be a student at the Tepper School at that time. It was called GSIA, the Graduate School of Industrial Administration. And I said, that's the guy I'm going to start a business with. So I stalked that poor guy. And so there was an event downtown. It was called Entrepreneur's Day. And there was, you know, it was like a trade show. But they had a VIP lunch. And you had to pay to get into the VIP lunch. So I snuck in the room and found the table with Don's name on it. I took two chairs and I put them up, like, to save the chairs. I snuck back out of the room, and it was like festival seating. So I ran and I snuck and got first in line at the door. And so they opened the doors and I ran to that table. And I sat there with my arm on the table with the chair, so no one took that chair next to me. And Don came in and I jumped up. Don, sit here. And so he came over and sat down right next to me. And at the time, he said he was going to retire from startups. And so I worked through the lunch to get my courage up. And I was nervous as hell. And finally, I looked at him. I said, Don, entrepreneurs never retire. You're going to start another company, and you're going to start it with me. And he started to laugh at me. But it wasn't like he was laughing at me like I'm an idiot. It was like, I can't believe you had the cojones to ask that question. And that started the relationship. And literally, we started the company while I was still a graduate student here at Carnegie Mellon. And it was called IndustryNet. And it grew in time to be the largest business-to-business site on the early internet in 1995. There's a rest of the story that I can tell you a little bit later in the Q&A, but that's how I got my start.
Awesome. Yeah. So what was, like, the biggest thing that you learned from starting that first company? I'm sure there were a lot of lessons, but one that comes to mind.
Great, great question, Arjun. Don Jones, my co-founder, was a great engineer and one of the greatest marketers that I have ever met. And so you would think I would answer, oh, this product development idea or this marketing technique. But it wasn't that at all. Don said to me very early on in our relationship, he said, Dave, everything good about a company is the people, and everything bad about a company is the people. And so if you're going to be successful as an entrepreneur, you need to focus on getting the very best people and creating a very good culture so that you can get the best productivity and the best version of those people every single day. And so that's something that I've remembered all my life, and it's something that we do now at the Swart Center in programs like the Innovation Scholars, which Archon is an Innovation Scholar at the Swart Center.
That is true. So how'd you end up at the Swart Center and running things at CMU?
Archon, I was pissed off. Do you know what I was pissed off about? MIT and Stanford were seen as great entrepreneurial universities, and Carnegie Mellon was not. Yet in research and academics, we were their equals. And I'm like, why? It doesn't have to be this way. And so, you know, I had been a multi-time entrepreneur starting companies, and I've also been a venture capitalist. So I knew the business inside and out, and I knew that we had the talent at Carnegie Mellon to get there, but we didn't have the culture. We didn't have the buy-in from the top of the university, and we didn't have the confidence in our alumni base to go start companies. Oh, we had really great entrepreneurs. Did you know that the iPhone, the first version, first four versions of the iPhone, were designed by Matt Rogers, who's an ECE undergrad and ECE master's here? He went on to found Nest Labs, yeah. Sold it to Google. It's now the Google Home platform, and now he's doing one of the coolest new startups called The Mill. It's taking food waste from your home and dehydrating it and turning it into chicken feed. That guy is amazing. And he started companies 10, 15 years ago, right? And we had people like that throughout our history. Adobe is a CMU startup.
I didn't know that.
Sun Microsystems is a CMU startup. But nobody knows these stories. So I wanted to come back and help Carnegie Mellon take its rightful place next to MIT and Stanford as a great startup university.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, I think everyone here would like to see CMU become one of those top dogs.
Well, we were just ranked the number 3 entrepreneurship university by Bloomberg Businessweek, and research at the Stanford School of Business by Ilya Strebulev, who studies where venture capital goes, on an index basis, now ranks Carnegie Mellon number 4 in unicorn founder creation.
Wow. Well, congrats to you.
This is a community, right? The second idea I learned from John Jones is it's about the people, and then it's network, 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 right? And so we've built a network of people that help each other. We have a global village at Carnegie Mellon.
I'm curious about one thing. You know, you talk about Stanford and Silicon Valley, a lot of times that culture, that network can be seen as something that just arises naturally, but part of your job is enacting concrete things that help create that network, help create that culture of entrepreneurship. What are some actions that you try to take to help make CMU the next big entrepreneurship university?
There's many. I will try to narrow it down to just a few high priority ones, not necessarily in any order. One is to provide the right framework and methodology for people to think about how to go about starting a business. And the one that we use here at Carnegie Mellon is one that's used many other places. It's called a lean, agile approach. And what people don't realize is that's really just the scientific method applied to business. And so these basic fundamentals, first principles, if you teach entrepreneurs to use them, then you can greatly increase their probability of success. So we try to give them the fundamentals, and then we try to give them the network. And there's 125,000 living CMU alumni all over the globe, and every single one of them should be a customer of our startups, a supplier to our startups, a mentor to our startups, and an investor to our startups. So we work really hard to leverage that network. So one-third of my job is connecting with investors, venture capitalists, angels and getting them to recognize that Carnegie Mellon is a great source of startups to invest in. We've created an angel network through a group called 99 Tartans, right? We've put an investment fund inside the Swartz Center called VentureBridge, a pre-seed investor fund. And it actually sometimes writes the first checks into the companies. So if you think about that, you know, we've got the fundamentals of how to approach building your startup, and we've got this network that can help get you customers, it can help get you investors. And where do you think the best talent source in the world is?
Right here.
Oh! How did you guess? being, you know, kind of funny about it, but the reality of it is Carnegie Mellon attracts the best and the brightest from all over the world. We get 3,000 new students that walk on this campus every year, and they're amongst the smartest people in the world. It, metaphorically, it's a renewable energy source, right? 3,000 of the smartest people come here. And if we can get them to understand that entrepreneurship is a career path for them, then we can build this beautiful network. We get a network effect that happens.
What are Pittsburgh's strengths and weaknesses as a future startup hub? Like, why should someone stay here and start a startup instead of moving to the Bay Area?
It's a great question. I'll start it off with something that a lot of people have heard of. Duolingo, which is one of our most successful Carnegie Mellon startups, stayed in Pittsburgh. And they wanted to recruit people as boomerangs that were out on the West Coast. So they put a billboard up on the 101, which is the highway that goes up and down Silicon Valley. And that billboard showed the picture of a Victorian mansion. It says, "See what $300,000 in Pittsburgh can buy you." So there are a lot of great qualities about Pittsburgh. But one that might not be top of mind for people is, did you know that Pittsburgh was the Silicon Valley of the Industrial Revolution? Why do you think it was?
A lot of steel.
Well, before steel, we had all of the resources, the minerals to make coal. Yeah. We could get iron ore from Minnesota across the Great Lakes and down the canals that were built. We had rivers to transport steel that was made. Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America, PPG, Pittsburgh Plate Glass. The Heinz Company was one of the first manufacturers of mass-produced food. All of these companies were here, and they created great wealth, which created foundations. And those foundations allowed Pittsburgh, even though we were a smaller city, to punch above our weight and to be a major league city with arts, with museums, right, with major league sports teams, right? And so we had all the amenities that a New York City would have, or a San Francisco would have, or a Chicago would have. But we had a small town feel, and we were affordable, right? Mm-hmm. You could buy a beautiful house in a nice suburban setting that's 12 minutes from downtown. That's my house, right? So there's a quality of life here because of all the amenities from our history and the affordability. Now you mix that with the talent at Carnegie Mellon, and you've got a strange brew that's pretty great.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, it seems like a pretty good town from how you're pitching it. Just a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Archon Das, here with Dave Mawinney of the Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship at CMU. When a lot of people, just regular people in the population, think of tech startups, they think of gentrification and hipsters with very expensive coffees. What are some of the ways in which startups can be positively transformative for a community like Pittsburgh? Why should a regular person want startups here?
You know, you talked about the veneer, the surface. You know, that exists. We can't change that. But the great entrepreneurs are not focused on how they look or how they're perceived. They're focused on delivering value to their customers and solving real problems, right? So again, that's one of the principles we try to teach our entrepreneurs is identify real problems that people need to solve, solve them better than anybody else can solve them. We have a concept called the goodness factor at the Swartz Center, right? And be humble about it. Don't be braggadocious, right? You don't see the folks at Duolingo who've created something brilliant actually out there bragging about themselves all the time, right? Mm. They've got this great Midwestern humility about, yes, we're proud of what we're doing. It's great. But we are doing it in service of our customers and our employees. And that's, you know, what we try to build here at Carnegie Mellon is value focus for your customers and be humble.
That makes sense. So I guess switching back to CMU, let's say I'm a starry-eyed freshman who's just come here for the first time and doesn't know much about startups, doesn't know much about entrepreneurship, but wants to learn more, wants to get interested in the scene. What are some things that I can do to help me get more involved in startups and you know, eventually achieve my dream?
The simple answer, and I'm going to give you a longer answer too, the simple answer is come to the Sports Center, right? We're a hub for making your entrepreneurial dreams come true. But here's the longer answer. A lot of these kids come here with a bad mindset from either their parents or from their teachers at their high school, which is you should go to work for the man or the woman. And you're the smartest people in the world. Why the hell would you want to go to work for a soul-sucking consultant, a bean-counting banker, or an evil tech monopolist when you can work for yourself? You can guide your own ship. You can determine your own destiny if you work for yourself. Now, obviously, that's a big joke, right? I'm just trying to sort of have a muse that we can bounce off of. Consulting companies, banks, tech companies are great, okay? But I want to help change the mindset of these young people that there is an alternative path. And the truth is, the research shows that entrepreneurs are happier than people that work for other people. And the reason is not because you get rich. That's a nice side effect, right? The reason that entrepreneurs are happier is they get to choose their own path. They have true freedom and liberty, right? When you're an entrepreneur, it's up to you. You make the decisions. Of course you have a boss. Your board is your boss. Your customers are your boss. Your employees are your boss. But you get to make the decision. And I'll say it again. To me, that's true freedom and liberty.
Is that sense of independence one of the reasons that you first got into entrepreneurship?
Absolutely. I went to work for a very large company in Pittsburgh as an intern, both in undergrad and during my graduate studies. And I was eager beaver, and I was the first person there, and I was the last person to leave. And what I noticed is people were coming in at 10, and they were leaving at 4, looking at their watch all day long. I felt I was in a zombie graveyard, and I said, there has to be something else. And that's what led me down. I had already decided I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but like many people, I was sort of dipping my toe in the big company water to see, does it make any sense? And it made no sense to me. And so I felt that... I didn't feel like I was better than anybody else, but I felt like I could do what other people could do. So what did I have to lose, right? I used to joke and say, I came into this world naked. I'm going to leave this world naked. It doesn't matter what I'm wearing in between, right? So I had no fear of failure. And so that's why I did it.
Yeah, so you probably get a lot of startups across your desk on any given week. So what's one interesting one that you've seen recently that you'd like to share with our audience?
Oh, Archon, you're asking me to say who my favorite child is.
Doesn't have to be the favorite, just the one that takes your interest.
Oh, so we have a lot of really cool ones. And I do get to work closely with a lot of different companies. One that was in the Sports Center today while we were doing our Connects workshop series was a company that's now called Trainwell. They recently changed their name from Copilot. They actually had the name Copilot before Microsoft came, but Microsoft came in and branded Copilot, and all of a sudden everybody was asking them, are you part of Microsoft? But Trainwell is amazing. They have built a one-to-one personal trainer capability on your smartwatch and your smartphone. And they enable a trainer who, if they were doing it in person, could maybe train 10 people a month. They allow that trainer to train 200 people per month using artificial intelligence. So they are just created this amazing capability. They started off, interestingly, thinking gym bros were their target market, the guys you see upstairs in the university center trying to pump themselves up, wearing those muscle shirts, right? And they actually found out women in their 30s that didn't want to go to the gym, that wanted someone to push them, wanted a sense of belonging to a community, even though it was online, was their target market, and they pivoted to that, and they've been growing incredibly rapidly. I think that's amazing because it's just one of the gazillion uses of artificial intelligence to improve people's lives. And why we're sort of specially suited to do that is artificial intelligence was invented here at Carnegie Mellon in the early 1950s, and robotics was essentially perfected here in the 60s and 70s. And so we have this opportunity to create new companies that are doing the most amazing things out of artificial intelligence and robotics.
Yeah, so Trainwell is definitely doing some really cool stuff, and they've found their niche. I'm curious, a lot of times it seems like startups are very difficult, obviously, and you have to work a lot. Yep. And at times it might feel like it's an uphill battle. What are some advantages that startups have over their competitors who are larger companies? Like, what are some things that startups can do better than a large company?
Well, startups are more nimble, right? Because of their smaller size, because of the mentality that the founders and the early employees bring to the table, is they can respond more quickly to customer needs. They can respond more quickly to market changes. They can respond more quickly to technology trends that change. So, for example, startups in 1995, the internet hadn't really existed in a mainstream way before that. And the company that we started, IndustryNet, actually was doing a printed publication and an electronic Yellow Pages we distributed on a diskette. But the internet happened, and we moved all of that information online and immediately became the largest business-to-business site on the internet, right? So if we were a larger company, we wouldn't have been nimble enough to make that change literally almost overnight. So that's one thing. Another thing that we have, if we build the right culture in a startup, is that our employees are excited to come to work every day. They're focused on delivering value to that customer. And that can drive a what we call a goodness factor, a value proposition that's compellingly better than what the competitors can provide.
So there are some advantages to being a startup over a big company.
Not some, many.
Many, many. So what's your passion? You clearly come to work every day and you're a really excited guy. What gets you out of bed in the morning?
So the story I didn't tell you about why I'm at the Swartz Center is I'm a Western Pennsylvania kid. I told you about the steel industry and metals industry going away and everybody leaving. And I had a concern that my children and my grandchildren might not be able to live in Western Pennsylvania if we did not have a diversified economy. And the eds and meds industries brought Pittsburgh back. But what I worried about is without a diversified economy based on technology and new things that were happening in the marketplace, that we might again face a plateau or a decline. So I wanted to build a startup community here that was vibrant. And when I looked at all the assets of the region, the number one asset was the people that come to Carnegie Mellon. So the reason that I come to work with a smile on my face and energy every day, Archon, is the people like you. I mean that sincerely. I just love the people that come here, and I want them to be able to, you know, follow their dreams and not feel boxed in by other people's perceptions or misconceptions.
Everyone at CMU who's interested in startups owes you a lot.
Thanks. Well, they owe themselves a lot, right? I mean, this is a community. It's a village, right? And it's really important to address that all the time. Is like, we have to be together to make this happen.
What are some of the things that the Swartz Center does, some of the activities that you would like our audience to know about?
Well, first of all, the Swartz Center is named after Jim Swartz, who's a Pittsburgh native and a CMU alum. He started the one of the top, if not the top, venture capital firms in the world, Accel, A-C-C-E-L. If you don't know the firm, you know the companies that he invested in and his team. They invested in Facebook. They were the first institutional investor. They invested in Slack. They invested them in when they were a different company and pivoted to become what they are, and a whole bunch of other companies that you would know. Jim believed the same thing that I believed, that Carnegie Mellon was an underutilized resource and that we could use the talent that came through Carnegie Mellon to build great companies and to build great economies. And so at its core, that's what the Swart Center is about, is to attract the best and the brightest and to help them by providing them the tools and the resources to actually be able to take their ideas and turn them into reality. We have 24 different programs and clubs at the Swart Center. It's not a one-size-fits-all capability. Anybody that comes in is going to take a different path than the others. We have a venture fund called Venture Bridge. We have a competition called the McGinnis Venture Competition. Some of my favorite programs are like the programs that you're in, Archant, the Innovation Scholars. And the Innovation Scholars is like a sorority or a fraternity for high potential entrepreneurs. And we have high diversity in that group. We have people from the different schools across campus. We have people from different ethnic origins. We have people from different lifestyles. You name a way to look at diversity, that's what we have. You're an innovation scholar. Why don't you tell us really quickly what an innovation scholar is? I'll be the interviewer now.
I would say that Innovation Scholars has been a really good program for learning that entrepreneurship is a real thing that you can do. I think when I first came to college, I was like everybody else. I wanted to get that, shiny looking job at Google. But I quickly found out that the thing that would fulfill me the best was probably working at a startup. I just didn't know how to make that real. And Innovation Scholars allowed me to connect with other students of the other Innovation Scholars, as well as meet this wide variety of really incredible people, these founders, these investors that we met when we went on our trip to Silicon Valley. So every winter break, the Innovation Scholars get taken on a week-long trip to Silicon Valley. And overall, it's been a really positive experience. So, yeah.
And the amazing thing to me, Archon, is that the alumni from Innovation Scholars are absolutely killing it. I can't believe how many great companies have been started by people that have been in the program that you were. You mentioned Matt Spatel a little bit earlier from Trainwell. Stella Hahn started Fractional, a way for friends to buy investment real estate properties together. Glenn Wise came to CMU last week. He started a cybersecurity company called Cinder. Mohawk Nada started a company called Atlas to make it easier to get visas to go back and forth to India and China and other places. I mean, the people that have been in this program are really creating life-changing companies. And that's what our goal is that we didn't do that. Those people did it on their own. They came up with the ideas. They made these things happen. But we hopefully created an environment that gave them the confidence to do it and some of the resources they needed to get there.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about that environment. Paul Graham, the founder of Y Combinator, probably the biggest accelerator in the world.
The biggest and the best in most people's minds.
Yeah. He grew up in Monroeville, so
He's a Pittsburgh native, yeah.
And he gave this talk on the future of Pittsburgh as a startup hub. He seems to be bullish about it. But one of the things that he talked about was these organic conditions for entrepreneurship to occur. Mm-hmm. Things that happen to correlate with founders meeting each other and starting really cool startups that go on to do big things. What are some of those organic conditions that you think are most important for the development of a healthy startup ecosystem?
Community, a sense of community, a sense of belonging, a place to go. And that's what we didn't have before the Swart Center, and we do have right now. Now, the Swart Center can't be the only place and the only community that we have in town. And I think that's what Paul's talking about. He started off in Boston with Y Combinator and moved it to the Bay Area. The Bay Area has all these micro communities that are just incredible. We're not going to try to recreate what's going on in the Bay Area, but we can create these micro communities that are here in Pittsburgh, the Swart Center being one of them. So I think if you get these micro communities that are, successful and vibrant in and of themselves, working with other micro communities to build a larger ecosystem, then you can have that success. And so, I'm very proud of what our team has built at the Swart Center, but we need more of that in more places. So I would like to see the University of Pittsburgh build upon the microculture and the micro community that they have there right now. I would like to see us be able to do that in downtown. What you've seen with Carnegie Mellon is the influence on Lawrenceville and the Strip District through Robotics Row, right? So even though that's connected to Carnegie Mellon, its own micro community down along the Allegheny River. So if we can do more of that, by creating these hubs of, you know, startup activity, I think we have a chance to be what Paul Graham thinks we can be.
It's been really great having you on the show, Dave. Again, this is Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Archon Das. I was here with Dave Mawinney, director of the Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship at Carnegie Mellon's Tepper School of Business. Thanks, Dave.
Hi, this is God. Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
And the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand, stand by me.
Hi, I'm Brad Keselowski, driver of the number 2 Discount Tire Ford Mustang. If there's one thing I've learned after years on the track, it's that having the right amount of pressure in your tires can make or break performance. Properly inflated tires are essential to the health of your car and to keep you driving safely. Check your tire pressure once a month, especially before road trips, or stop by your neighborhood tire retailer for help.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
Life's the same. I'm moving in stereo. Life's the same, except for my shoes. Life's the same. You're shaking like tremolo. Life's the same. It's all inside you.
should she go out when the TV's on? Whatever moves beyond these walls, she'll know the facts when Sunday comes along. If you wanna know about the mad punk rockers, if you wanna know how to play guitar, if you wanna know about any other suckers, you can read it in the Sunday papers. Read it in the Sunday papers. Sunday papers, don't ask no questions. Sunday papers, don't get no lies. Sunday papers, raise objections. Sunday papers, ain't got no eyes.
What you say? This is Little Fat Swallow, my mother's 285 pounds of jam, jive, and everything. They got me in on this V-Disc mess here this afternoon, so here it is. Watch out. One of my own compositions ain't misbehaving, and I ain't either. On the elevation, on the shelf, ain't misbehaving, saving my love for you, and you, especially you, yes, I know for certain, the one I love, I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of, ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you. like that honor in a corner. Don't go nowhere. What do I care? Your kisses are worth waiting for.
Believe me,
I don't stay out late, no place to go. I'm home about 8 at my little radio. A misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, yes, you. All my love for you. Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
From the Auburn, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh on 88.3 FM. Suckers.
Game.
lost in sorrow. Ain't a day goes by that I can't satisfy. And keep on pushing. Love, keep on pushing. Good.